adaptation to a changing climate, continuing to probe just what happened with the oil spill. Are we ready for some perspective? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Yes, there are plenty of books out, but these two by Alaskan women stand out. They are writers and activists. Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422. Email talk@aprn.org. They may be coming soon to a discussion forum near you, and two of them are with us today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. When you file online for your PFD, you can donate to any of the 159 Alaska organizations that provide help to individuals and families affected by a disability or mental illness. Get more with your PFD when you pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation and the Friends of the Alaska Children's Trust. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, the title of the two books in question here are The Heart of the Sound, an Alaska Paradise Found and Nearly Lost, and Early Warming, Crisis and Response in the Climate-Changed North. That covers a lot of bases there. Mary Beth Hallman is the author of the first book, Heart of the Sound. How are you doing, Mary Beth?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having us.
So the two of you, you and Nancy Lord, are going on this tour. You were just in Fairbanks? How was that?
Yes, we were. It was great. It was 40 below and wonderful. We did three things there. We did a signing at Gulliver's Books. We had a conversation moderated by Robert Hannon at the Unitarian Church.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
A colleague in public broadcasting.
Right. Yeah, he was great. And then last night, we were part of the Northern Voices series of the Northern Alaska Environmental Center.
Wow. So it's obvious that you're definitely in the environmentalist side here. I'd say. Activist is the word I used.
Yes.
Nancy Lord, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Welcome back.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you. Yeah.
Your latest book, I mean, Mary Beth's book is still talking about the spill. I think you would say, Mary Beth, it changed your life, yes?
Yes.
Yes.
Most definitely.
And for you, Nancy, it seems to me the thing that changed your life was giving up your set net site.
Well, I am no longer fishing, but it frees me to do more writing and more traveling.
And you teach, both of you teach now, right?
I teach in the graduate writing program at UAA.
And you, Mary Beth, too, you're teaching writing?
I'm teaching workshops here and there, and that's it.
Mm. Well, I remember some time ago you did a workshop. You and Gretchen Legler did a workshop on outdoor writing. And silly me, I thought it was like writing for Field and Stream or something. But what you meant was you're supposed to go outdoors and you're supposed to be outdoors while you write.
Right. Yep, that's what we did. We took people outside and gave them writing exercises and set them loose. It was wonderful.
That it was a revelation to me to realize that the impressions that I might get written down when I was outdoors in the environment I was writing about would be quite different from what I might take back and upon reflection write. And this is very handy for me. Mm. Very handy for me, you know, I'm a professional writer, I suppose, but I always write to a certain form and style. But, all my training was in art, so I'm used to, like, going out and visually, you know, I like a plein air and sketching and all that sort of thing, and being in that fresh environment and making those fresh impressions, I could understand that, but I didn't ever think of applying it to writing. But that workshop was helpful to me, and also there was one of the training sessions at Press Club years ago where they said when you have your notebook out, just write down everything that you see and smell and taste and experience, and you'd be amazed. Most of it you're just going to throw away, but there will be something that tells. It is telling. There are reasons why you're noticing these things, and those details are going to speak. you know, they're going to get through. So, Nancy, your evolution seems fairly straight. You have kind of an autobiography in between this and the Fish Camp book, yes?
Oh, and a couple other books in between there, too.
Okay, go ahead.
A book called Green Alaska, kind of about the Harriman Expedition. And then my beluga book called Beluga Days.
Oh, yes. How could we forget that?
Yeah, it's had quite a bit of attention because we're still trying to protect the Cook Inlet beluga whales.
Yeah, well, and I guess it's still undetermined.
Well, we're still waiting for the critical habitat area to be made. And I'm actually a member of the recovery team on the stakeholders group of that. So I've been involved in some of those meetings.
Yeah, I was. It was interesting. I had a conversation with Roderick Hobbs, mm-hmm. and he was kind of lining out what the latest research is. And what it seems to boil down to is they just do not, they live quite long, and they do not reproduce very fast.
That's correct. So it's hard. Yeah, it's hard to recover a very small population of slowly reproducing animals. Yes.
Yeah. So there's a lot of attention going on. Well, how much can we find out and how much do we really know about how fast they reproduce, and is there anything we can do to encourage them?
Yes, that's the idea with the recovery plan. Make it as easy as possible for them to reproduce and be healthy and recover their numbers.
Well, you're kind of writing you seem most comfortable going to the science and the fact and trying to get to the bottom of things. You're almost a journalist in the way that you approach it, but, seems to me.
Yeah, these last couple of books have been sort of more journalistic, I guess. Sort of, I call them maybe literary journalism, and kind of experiential. I try to take myself into places and situations and write from the experience, and then fold in some of the science and politics.
And Early Warming, Crisis and Response in the Climate Changed North. You did manage to get to a bunch of places. This must be difficult budgetarily.
Well, you should have seen the first book proposal that I was trying to sell. I really intended to be more sort of circumpolar around the north.
Well, you got as far as Canada.
Yeah, I got as far as Canada. The advance wasn't enough. As you know, it's very expensive to travel in Alaska. But I did get to enough places to sort of demonstrate what I wanted to do, which is that people in the north are experiencing climate change now, and they're coping with it and adapting. And I wanted to sort of show the readership that it's not easy. So I'm hoping to kind of convince people that they really do need to act to mitigate the change and make it not, you know, less bad rather than more bad.
Yeah, adaptation is adaptation is not an option.
Yeah, well, we do have to do that to a large degree. And the other thing I wanted to show too was that people in the north, especially Native people, are have been very adaptive and innovative and resilient for a very long time, and that we have things that we can learn from them.
Yeah, I was happy at the Arctic Science Symposium that a bunch of people from Nelson Island came forward on their own idea and said, we'd like to talk to you about, you know, our traditional knowledge and how it interrelates with science. Mm. And a lot has to do with getting the young people to retain what comes from the elders. And they said it's important about the language. And what it turned out, in Phenip Reardon was kind of facilitating in this, in her very nice, transparent way that she does these things. Mm. And they were, what seemed to be important that it had not soaked into me before, was even if you can find a younger person who remembers the way that certain things were said and when they were said by the elders. In other words, how is the phrase actually applied so that it sinks in? And mm-hmm. I hadn't really thought about that deeply, about a traditionally passed on culture and how this knowledge might be encoded in the actual language and in the occasion in which the language is applied.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. Fascinating. And so here we are with a room full of scientists and a few people from Nelson Island down at the end of the table, And there's one point where they're telling a story about the little people.
Oh.
I'm in a science meeting, and everybody's sitting here listening to a story about the little people. Something is changing here.
Yeah.
And I did have that feeling throughout the conference, the Arctic or the Marine Science Symposium, that maybe things were cracking open a little bit in terms of people just casting aside some of the usual roles that they feel they have to have. You know, the scientist always has to be cautious, you know, and the you know, the public always has to be ignorant, and everything has to be on some kind of lofty level. I sense a little breaking down of that this time around, with people just thinking, you know, we got some real work to do here. We need to really work together, those that want to, and start getting things done. Well, before I'd like to get some readings for both of these. We'll probably give our listeners a good sense of what you're about. We've got Mary Beth Holloman, author of Heart of the Sound and Alaska, Paradise Found and Nearly Lost, and Nancy Lord, author of Earth Early Warming, Crisis and Response in the Climate Change North. And we're open for business and your calls at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Before we invite the readings, I would like to put the calls through here for a few minutes. Guy and Valdez, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, I would like to know, you know, with this acid rain that we're having, that, you know, everybody's talking about, you know, the oceans have increased by 30 to 25% is what I've been reading and hearing. But, you know, aren't we, the same rain is coming down on our soil. It's also working into our groundwater, and I don't hear anybody talking about that. And then, you know, that dead zone that they have out in the Gulf of Mexico, I've been hearing about that as long as I've been hearing about the global warming thing. And last time I heard something on NPR, this guy that's been studying these over the years, it's been increasing, and now I hear there's over 320 of these. And and I hear about us being able to adapt, but, you know, I'm not being, our animal life and our plant life on this planet isn't going to be able to adapt like we can.
I don't know. I think some of the animals, especially short-lived animals, are
already
they're actually reproducing faster than human beings do, and they're adapting rather quickly. I think I'm going to cut you off here, Guy. Guy, that's enough. It's amazing how much stuff you can pick up off of public broadcasting and the internet. But let's take Guy raised about 5 points. And I'll take the dead zones first. The dead zones essentially have to do with the runoff from the rivers and the fact that there's too much nutrients. They make too much slime, basically, and all the slime eats up all the oxygen, and then the water goes dead. And this does happen. It's happened in a number of places. There's also some strange oceanographic conditions that have caused a bad dead zone off the California and Oregon coast. It's difficult. They're still trying to figure it out. Probably has something to do with prevailing winds. And this is all separate from the spill. Now, as for adaptation, Nancy, I think you saw very quickly, starting with spruce bark beetles, that adaptation is happening real quick, especially by wildlife, for better or for worse.
Well, yeah.
And by plants.
In some cases, But Guy, I think Guy has a very good point about how interrelated everything are. I mean, there are lots of environmental insults happening kind of all at once, and they all do interlock into making things difficult. Some creatures adapt well, you know, rats, for example, cockroaches, some of these things can adapt very well, other things with great difficulty. So it's not happening at the whole system gets kind of put off. But I'd really like to address the one point he made. There was a little confusion between acid rain and ocean acidification.
Great. I'm glad you're going there.
Yeah. And I talk about ocean acidification in my book. And again, Guy was correct that the carbon dioxide that's going into the atmosphere from human-caused reasons like carbon emissions from the burning of fossil fuels and deforestation, about a third of that is being absorbed in the oceans. And so it has changed the chemistry of the oceans. It's more acidic than it was. About 30% more acidic. And that is already having effects on the ocean ecosystem. And it's corrosive to those creatures that build shells.
Yeah, it's two shows back. We had Jeremy Mathis on briefly from University of Alaska Fairbanks. He's got enough money to get some lab equipment and set up a center for actually running these samples through. And he, as you know, 2 years ago, convinced a bunch of scientific vessels to go ahead and take the samples. And he published those results last year, and they were pretty shocking.
Yep.
Because this is a hard thing to measure. There's a lot of chemistry involved and expensive lab work and so forth. But he went ahead and ran these samples, and they showed in the Beaufort Sea that we're getting high acid levels. And this has hardly been measured. This has not been measured very much. It has to be over a period of time. There's all these currents. There's a whole lot of different variables in there. But the fact of the matter is the acidity is there, and he's got a lot more measurements, but nothing to report until probably next year.
Yeah. Yeah, he's doing absolutely groundbreaking work. And he's in my book in the last part of it.
I noticed.
And it's not just, you said the Beaufort Sea, but it's all of coastal Alaska, the shallow waters up that are, you know, now up over the continental shelf, and in fact all along the west coast of North America, the same things are being found. Very, very serious.
Yeah, and this is not one of those things where you can say, well, it's no proof it's human caused. This has nothing to do with that. You get more carbon dioxide, you're going to get more acidic oceans. It's very simple. It's a pure chemical thing, purely chemical. Okay, I think we'll go to the spill and the. One thing that is happening, I think, with the climate warming and your book, Nancy Lord, brings it out very, very eloquently. I think is that it's not as if it's entirely unprecedented. You can kind of look back over the last, let's say, 55 million years, and find just about anything you see now having happened. But it's a question of how fast. And the speed with which the carbon dioxide is increasing and the speed with which things are changing is just, you wouldn't see that in fossil record even if it were there, because it happened so fast it would not be preserved. you'd have it be this way and then suddenly be that way. And that seems to be what we're dealing with, is that what would take you normally thousands of years, and there'd be all sorts of ways for wildlife to adapt and so forth, is actually taking place in, you know, decades.
Yes, that's the point. It's the speed of change that's difficult to deal with.
Yeah. And it's also difficult from a media point of view in terms of how to describe, in terms of how, you know, where's the language? And it's not real well. It's not real easy to express in a news story, let me put it that way. Well, Mary Beth, I am trying to set the scene for you to give us a little reading from this book of yours,
right.
The Heart of the Sound.
Okay. This is near the end of the book. This is some years after the oil spill, when I'm noticing other changes to the sound. Why do we call things disasters only when they happen swiftly? These incremental, cumulative damages are an irreversible erosion of the place. Chesapeake Bay, the Everglades, the California coast, the wild prairies. No oil spill, no fire, no bomb has desecrated these places. It happened with one more outboard cutting awake, one more factory dumping waste, one more exotic plant taking hold, one more acre of wetland filled or forest cut or beach levee built for one more house. We accommodate these incremental damages, adjust ourselves to them, learn to ignore them, just as we adjust to the poisoning of our own air and water, to the noise pollution that deafens us. Scientists call this phenomenon shifting baselines. Judging the amount of deterioration based on an already deteriorated environment. Our vision of a healthy, intact coral reef, for example, is now based on one that is already much less diverse, much less fecund than what we considered a healthy coral reef 20 or 50 years ago. We shift our very notion of reality. We name it, we study it, we acquiesce to it. We roll up the car windows in traffic, plug in headphones, build fences between our homes and our highways. We avert our eyes. How else can we get out of bed each morning?
That's really thought through. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mary Beth Holloman, a little bit from The Heart of the Sound. And I guess almost have to ask this. It's more than 20 years, and you're still writing about this.
Well, these stories need to not be forgotten. And, you know, this book is a cautionary tale. I think the BP Gulf of Mexico spill, and when that happened last summer, it was like a 21-year echo for a lot of us. The things that we heard fishermen and native elders saying there could have been pulled straight from the Exxon Valdez oil spill almost 22 years ago. So I think that we need to remember these stories. We need to not forget. So, and also the oil spill, I see it now as a warning shot to us about what our oil addiction is doing to us. It was a very swift, immediate disaster, and climate change is this incremental, cumulative, long-term, mostly invisible disaster that we seem to be trying to just adapt to.
Where do you get your hope? I mean, I'm serious. The two of you are motivated enough to undertake this tour. I'm sure you're not making any money off of it, to say the least. And, you know, you're what, speaking tonight again? you know, Fairbanks, you did three different places. And you've got how many in Anchorage are you doing?
We're doing one here tonight, and then we'll be in Homer Friday night.
Okay. Where do you get the strength to do it?
Well, there's this movie called The Year of Living Dangerously.
Yeah, there is.
And Robert Hannon remembered this same quote. It's one that drives me. There's a guy in that film who keeps saying, "What then shall we do? What then shall we do?" And, you know, that just plays in my head. I feel like I'm on this planet. I shouldn't just be taking up space. I should be being of use. And this is a way I can be of use. Writing is something I know how to do. So that's what I do.
Nancy Lord, what then shall we do?
Yeah, that would be my answer too, except Mary Beth is much more articulate than I am. One thing when I was writing this book, I mean, there have been lots of books written about climate change, and I've been kind of annoyed with so many of them that always seem to feel like they need to end on some note of hope, like, you know, after all this sort of disaster and everything, if, you know, now a call to arms, a call to action, you know, everyone go out and change your light bulbs. And I vowed when I was writing this that I would not end that way, because that's not the real answer. And we need sort of global cooperation with governments and industry, and you know, we need a price on carbon. We need some big changes.
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, I was reading today, it looks like Obama, Carol Browner is leaving the Obama administration, and she's one of the last advocates for activism about climate change. And they're just saying, well, there's no hope of getting anything out of Congress in the next 2 years, so they want to focus on other things. And you think, well, you know, 2 years, maybe in 2 years, 2 years of, you know, hurricanes and you know, strange weather and odd things happening to our fisheries and so forth, maybe people will be ready then to realistically look at realistically pricing carbon.
Well, you know, I think it's important to look beyond our own country. That's a place I find hope. When I see what other countries are doing to address this, they're not waiting for the United States to lead, because I don't think we're going to. I think we need to get out of the way, and I think that other countries, especially in Northern Europe, are already putting in place alternative energy projects, are already looking at reducing carbon emissions and a lot of communities in the United States are taking the charge. I know that Homer has done some. I know that California has done some. So I think my hope comes from beyond our federal government, because I think it's a broken system.
Well, but it's a shame that we're setting such a bad example, and because we're such
a
dominant country, and we can't do any better than we seem to be doing.
Oh yeah, well I mean, but I mean we can console ourselves by looking at how much worse the Chinese are building with all their coal-fired power plants and so forth, and emitting even more. You know, I mean, there's always some scapegoat, you know.
Well, let's not sell them any coal. How's that?
Somehow I had a feeling that might come up. but it is this carbon economy. I think what people are unable to think through is when you sign a treaty, you have to consider not so much where you stand now as to how you got. You have to step back. It's not as if not being efficient about carbon isn't going to have to be paid for later on in the carbon economy. You know, it's not like we are everybody, you know, if the European nations and so forth have gotten this far and we're still back here, the treaty has to engineer a way for us to start catching up with them. And that's not going to be, that gets harder every year it's put off.
But exactly.
I don't know. I suppose it's kind of a political matter. But, I mean, just in terms of, economic matter, sooner or later, there will be a price on carbon. Right. And that's going to change investment decisions.
Right.
And I suppose there are many that are making investment decisions that are investing a whole lot of money and trying to keep that from happening or put that off from happening. Let's go to Roberta in Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Roberta.
Good morning. It's Nancy, it's so wonderful to hear you on the air. And Mary Beth, beautifully written and said. And so one of my frustrations is the disconnect between the Alaska government and the environmental reality. And so I'm just odd about oil and gas, especially oil development discussions in the paper and on the radio, and literally no discussion, never even said in the same article about ocean acidification and the pollution. And then we have the Chewitna coal and the intense degradation of the environment that will occur, will happen. And so with the amount of information available, one of my big things is how do we make more successful inroads to convince our government we need to change? That seems to be kind of the biggest question. And I keep coming up with a very simple solution, but I don't know how to get from here to there. And one of them would be to lower the speed limit to 55 miles an hour and turn off all the unnecessary lights nationwide and worldwide. And in that, we would save an immense amount of energy and et cetera. So balance between the economy and the environment and just getting from where we are to there. Thank you.
All right, Roberta. Thoughts, either one of you? Getting from here to there.
You're right. We have the knowledge, we have the technology, we have the science to deal with this problem. At the polar bear meeting I was at last Friday at the Science Symposium, Steve Amstrup said, you know, if we start cutting our carbon emissions, or even if we just keep it at 450, get it to 450 and keep it there, the polar bears will persist in all regions, which is great news. Of course, it takes some political will.
Hey, we're only at 390 now.
And I went to a talk by James Lovejoy. And is that right? Yes.
Lovelock?
Lovejoy.
Yeah.
Okay. It was the one who coined the term biodiversity. And
Lovejoy.
He said that plants could save us. He said there are two other times in our planet's history where the planet was warming at an increased rate, and the first time it came down was when terrestrial plants first arrived on the scene. The second time it was brought down was when flowering plants first arrived on the scene. So he said, you know, if we start reforesting all these areas, if we stop slash and burn agriculture and stop black carbon, which is entering the atmosphere through soot, there's all these. So we have the ability, the political will, Boy, that's the million-dollar question. And I think that each of us just have to keep speaking to our representatives. We have to keep writing letters and working as groups and as individuals to get that out.
Yeah, I mean, I think politicians go where they think the constituency is. And if they lose a constituency, then they have to scramble to catch up. That's what it boils down to eventually. More on this as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com, and by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you're an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're getting someplace between science and environmentalism and eloquent writing with Mary Beth Holloman and Nancy Lord. And, wow, there's so many different places to take this, but I think, Nancy, I want to Mary Beth brought up this idea of plants saving the world. And you kind of explore this in that Canadian chapter in your book. The idea that it just could be that there will be large, vast sections of the earth that will be used as carbon sinks.
When I visited the Northwest Territories in Canada, they're engaged in a program called the Protected Area Strategies to try to conserve big parts of the boreal forest there as a buffer against climate change. And it was interesting coalitions that are working on that, really led by Native people who see the connection between having, you know, protecting against climate change and also traditional use of the same areas and so on. But you know, I'm, try to be careful about looking for easy answers for any of this. And this issue of whether these forested areas, I mean, right now they hold a lot of carbon, and that's great, and we want to preserve them. But as the earth warms, a lot of that begins to be released. And
I assume you've talked to Glenn Judet about this.
Yeah, Terry Chapin I've talked to, and Glenn's work I'm very familiar with.
Right, so you know he doesn't really hold out much hope for much of the boreal forest. He thinks it's drying out right now and dying.
And, dying and moving, and it doesn't really have time. It's dying faster than it's moving north, essentially, is what's happening. So, but then there's also a lot of carbon in the soils in the boreal area, too.
Yeah. Well, one thing that's been a mystery to the climate modelers is the methane. It would seem that there's more and more methane going in the atmosphere, but it's not being read there. We seem to have a reprieve on methane at the moment. Methane measurements have not really gone up for about 10 years. Nobody quite knows why, because it, from every indication, there's more methane coming up into the atmosphere that we're not seeing.
Yeah. Now, there are a lot of mysteries associated with this, which is why people get so confused about climate change and, you know, whether it's real or not.
I was shocked. I had the epiphany about 4 years ago. They were talking about all the models, and I was in this workshop. It was at the AAAS, so some of the really top people in this. And a couple of them were just very, very insistent to say, look, just look at what our models have predicted, and look what's happened. They have underpredicted every single effect. When they say the climate models are not applying to the way the climate's coming out, it's because they never make it as bad as it turns out.
Right. They're all too conservative.
That's just plain wild. It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about environmentalism We're talking about environmental activism. We're talking about a couple of books, The Heart of the Sound and Early Warming. And our next caller, Steve from Wasilla, been so patient. Steve, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning. Good morning, Nancy and Mary Beth.
Morning.
What do you say, Steve?
Well, I was just wondering if you two gals had read Nick Begich's book, Angels Don't Play This Harp, or Jerry Smith's Weather Warfare.
I'm familiar with both of those. I've heard of them, but I have not read them.
Why do you think we're getting weather modifications, Steve? Do you think we're getting a deliberate weather modification warfare? Is that where you're going with this?
Absolutely. Jerry Smith outlines it very detailed in his book, and he's quoted Mark Begich quite a lot. They're compadres, evidently, and they've worked together. So I don't know if anybody's noticed, but we haven't had many northern lights for about 4 years now, and it coincides with the HARP project coming online.
Yeah, they did. And, they did pick up a little bit this year. Yeah, go ahead.
So anyway, the climate change is like they're flipping a switch or something like that. It's just been ridiculous, and it's gotten worse and worse. It's really escalating, if we get to the bottom of this, we got to look at a secret government, a hand behind the government pulling the strings, and it's about money. It's about the New World Order, and I know a lot of the audience out there will probably think I'm a nutcase, but if you do the footwork and do the reading and research, they all point in that direction. So
yeah, okay, Steve. Well, I know that. Yeah, I know the HARP project is not forthright about what is actually happening out there. I will say that, Nancy Lord.
Yeah, I want to say it's not Mark Begich's book. It's his brother Nick.
Yes.
And Mark Begich, who's our senator, has actually been pretty good on some of this climate change stuff and, supporting Arctic studies and some of the necessary research and so on. So I have a good word to say for him.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm sure Mark appreciates it. Steve, thanks for your call from Wasilla. It is Talk of Alaska. We've got Mary Beth Holloman and Nancy Lord with us. We're talking about writing about environmental issues and Tom joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. I guess my concern is the politicians not taking fossil fuel burning seriously, and they don't realize the danger involved. They don't realize, for example, that if the people of China switch from their bicycles to two-cycle motorcycles, that the 6 Western states will be uninhabitable in the United States. And some of this information is available in a reference that I have. It's called Alcohol Can Be a Gas by David Bloom. And he points some of these facts out. And that book's been around for about 30 years. And yet we got our politicians want to jack up rig in the inlet and drill, baby, drill. And they need to understand that our agricultural people can supply all our needs for fuel if they give it a chance.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the track record is not real good as far as food prices are concerned and biofuels, in my humble opinion. The use of corn is probably in the not best way. Oh, yeah. Here comes my email. Lovejoy Lovelock, wait a minute. Your guest Mary Beth mentioned James Lovejoy. She did indeed mean to refer to James Lovelock. Wikipedia. Let's look.
I'm pretty sure it's Lovejoy. There is a Lovelock.
There are both.
Different guy.
But okay. They're different guys.
You're right, yeah.
Lovejoy was the one that was here in Anchorage.
I remember Lovelock now because he
Lovelock was
with,
the guy.
Margulis. Yeah. And Lynn Margulis was right, as it turned out. Well, it is Talk of Alaska. And Nancy Lord, I think we've come to the point where I'd like to get a little reading from you, from your book, Early Warming, Crisis and Response in the Climate-Changed North. And I guess I would reiterate to the listeners, this is basically kind of ground truthing what's actually happening out there in terms of climate change.
Okay. I'll read a little bit from the part that's about my visit to Shishmaref. I think most Alaskans are familiar with it. And I went up there in 2009, and Tony Weyuana, who's been very instrumental in sort of positioning Shishmaref as a kind of the poster child of climate change, took me over to the mainland where the village has selected a new site to move to. It's called the Tin Creek site, and I'll read a little bit about there. But I think people know, I mean, Shishmaref needs to move. It's on a barrier island. It's one of the highly endangered areas because it's just eroding because of the loss of sea ice. So over there at the new site, the tundra, the sky, the skipping by small birds and the flocks of ducks over the river, the deep quiet, the sweet smell of the crushed plants beneath us, it was hard for me to sit in such a place and to anticipate a construction zone or a village. My mind stuck on the current village with its poorly built government houses, four-wheelers parked by the post office, children playing, meat and fish hanging, smell of sewage, and steady drone of the power plant. But the new village would be built with a plan, and that plan would include new technologies and concepts of sustainability. Weyuana talked, and it was clear he held a particular, perhaps even utopian, vision in his own mind. In the new village, houses would not be crowded on top of one another, and they would be built for energy efficiency. They would have plumbing and pump out sewage tanks instead of water barrels and honey buckets. There would still be a need for fuel tanks and fuel, but at least some of the electricity would come from wind or other renewable sources. There would be a new clinic and new school building. The village, in a safe and permanent place, might become a service hub for the rest of the region, might build an economy from that. Most of all, in Weyuana's vision, Shishmaref's people would be together and would still have access to their traditional lands and resources, without the constant worry of living on a disappearing island and with room to grow. Young people and their families would stay in the community, would embrace and carry on the culture. Those who had left would want to return. I want us to use as little fossil fuel as we can, Weyuana said. He told me earlier that both gasoline and fuel oil were presently priced in Shishmaref at $7.50 per gallon. Subsistence is an important part of our lives. We don't have an economic base. It's important that in our planning we ask, how can we be more efficient in using resources? The ongoing studies were moving the project forward, however slowly. They would help identify the best, cheapest, most sustainable way to do the job. As the village grant writer, Weyuana was doing what he could, including applying for funds for small-scale projects, some wind and solar. Shishmaref can show the way, he stressed. Shishmaref's relocation could be seen as a demonstration project to show how communities and government agencies can work together to both respect the cultures and needs of the relocating communities and be cost-effective. He didn't say it, but Weyuana's implication was clear. Shishmaref's climate-induced need to move was only among the first of the flood to come.
Yeah, can show the way. That is eerily resonant of last week's program. We were talking about the wind energy being put up next to the power plants, and that basically there's been so much can-do-ism and roll-up-your-sleeves-ism in Alaska that we're starting to lead the world in this now. You know, we've got exportable expertise, and the same thing with relocation. I mean, there certainly are a lot of design problems that it looks like he's very conscious of, and looking at ways to make some headway in what just about anybody knows there's some pretty substantial design problems we have in Alaska. Yeah.
I mean, we will be showing something. I mean, because we're on the forefront of all this, I mean, we'll either be showing that sort of can-do solving problems, or we're going to show what a miserable failure we are at dealing with this problem.
Well, so we've had no end of miserable failures. I keep perusing Alaska history and the All you have to do is look at Katala, basically. Mm-hmm. Mary Beth, you know Katala, right?
I do. I've been there, yeah.
So you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many times have they tried to develop that? They're still trying to develop it, you know. They said at one time they thought this was going to be the colossal wealth right there. And it's just sort of tucked back there.
Yeah.
Still sitting there.
Well, we have no shortage of big dreams in this state, that's for sure. It's just that perhaps we need to evolve our dreams a bit more towards sustainability and small-scale projects. You know, I think a lot about how we have known all this for so long. I've got this stack of books sitting on my desk that's from the 70s, back when I was in college. Shoemaker, Small is Beautiful. You know, a book about economics as if people mattered and trying to have small scale projects that I think can be much more successful.
Well, let's see. I'm trying to figure out where to go in the little time that we have left. It is Talk of Alaska. Mary Beth Holloman and Nancy Lord is with me. And I think I want to go a little bit more into your little roadshow for your two books, The Heart of the Sound and Early Warming, and what you're finding with the audiences that turn out. I mean, first off, obviously you're already preaching to the choir. People are interested in this issue. That's why they come. But what is the common ground that is found?
Everyone wants to know what they can do and what we need to say to make our government start making these shifts. And I think also we are all realizing that we need to get beyond preaching to the choir. And how do we do that? How do we reach out? There was a woman in the audience last night who said she talks to students. She's a teacher. And she said, climate change is difficult to grasp, but sustainability is easier for them to grasp. And population issues are easier for them to grasp. So they are ways of talking about it that perhaps might make it more adaptable to the conversation and reach beyond the choir.
And a lot of village people talk about self-reliance as being the goal, which is another way of looking at it. Just, you know, providing more of their own local foods and fuel, and that really helps address the problem.
And what we're getting, I think, from the callers to the show is people they're kind of scraping around looking for solutions, you know, digging around on the internet, any conspiracy theory, whatever it is, like you know, we got to solve this problem. You know, maybe this will work. Maybe this what's happening is you know, somebody's pulling strings for the HAARP project, whatever. But you know, they're thinking they got their. There may be a tinfoil hat involved, but they still have got that thinking cap going. Mark in Kenai, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. I guess, yeah, my comment would go to the, you were talking about exporting our expertise and our ideas. And I guess, unfortunately, we're stuck in denial too much, and it isn't happening. The one thing we have in this country that we could be exporting, we're not using right now. I haven't listened to this whole conversation, but earlier you mentioned about, well, at least we're better than the Chinese. But I think that goes a little bit to the reporting, because when I listen to other stories on NPR, because I don't do Fox, but then I hear other things that the Chinese actually, they're building a lot of coal plants, but they're doing that more for the short term. They're also investing very big in green energy. They bought some cutting-edge solar technology from out of California a year ago or so in some company there. And they've got, you know, rare earth materials. We don't hear that much. All these materials that have to go into the green technologies, Chinese are providing maybe up to 90% of the world's supply of that stuff right now. And they're starting to hold back on that because they want to use it for themselves. So I just think, you know, we need to be, suddenly we're thinking Chinese are bad, bad, bad. And then suddenly it's going to be like, whoa. They're way ahead of us, just like, you know, Europeans have gone ahead of us. So, I just wish that talking about preaching to other than the choir. I don't know how you start to get that across, that we're just going to be left behind if we don't get going on this stuff.
Yeah, Mark, I didn't mean really to to be bad-mouthing China. I think
I hear that all the time.
Yes.
You know, you hear that from the other side. It's like,
right. But it's,
we're not going to do anything until the Chinese do something. Well, they are, actually.
Yeah, they are. It is true. It's just that the scale is so enormous that these things are going on at the same time. But the fact of the matter is that the leaders of China may be communist or whatever you call that now, but they also really adhere to this sort of pragmatic Confucius type of ethic, and they are looking ahead, and they think of themselves as looking ahead much more than we do in this country.
Yeah.
And that's just a fact. As talk of Alaska,
they've got problems.
Yes,
they've got problems, and they admit it and face it. You know.
Yep.
So,
thank you, Mark. As talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com. No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
Opinions expressed on this program have absolutely nothing to do with what keeps the wheels turning. Well, China. Nancy Lord, you wanted to chime in on that.
Yeah, just briefly. Mark from Kenai was exactly correct about China looking ahead and planning for a greener future. And I just wanted to say that it's a lot easier to do with an authoritarian kind of government than in a democracy. If you have some kind of top-down leadership that can make things happen, you can do it. In a democracy where we're just can't seem to agree on anything, and it's tough. It's a tough problem, and I think the people need to lead on this one. The politicians aren't going to do it.
Back to the email where Cree chimes in again and says, "Hey, wait a minute. The problem with Lovejoy Lovelock is that it's Thomas Lovejoy."
That's the problem. It's Thomas Lovejoy and James Lovelock. Thank you.
All right, we got to the bottom of that one. We did make the wheels turn a little bit. Dave in Talkeetna, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. And hi, ladies. Boy, wonderful, wonderful writing. What an inspiration. As you guys have probably noticed, the Department of Transportation is upgrading Parks Highway northward. And their policy seems to be to clear-cut the whole 300-foot right-of-way. And in these days of worries about climate change, we're trying to do our little part to save all the trees we can. And they can't come up with any good reasons for clearing that wide. So we have a petition going, and if anybody sees it, I wish they'd sign it. And if you people have suggestions as to who we could approach to change DOT's policy, we'd love to hear it.
Well, Nancy?
I would just say one of the very good things that Sarah Palin did when she was governor was to establish a climate change sub-cabinet that did a lot of very, very good work and put out reports that apparently are on a shelf somewhere. But it was really all about that every state agency and every state action should consider climate change as part of it. And so every bit of transportation planning should be considering, not just how to engineer roads for future where, the permafrost might be thawing or whatever, but how to hold on to carbon in the trees and so on. And if those recommendations would be adopted by the state administration and the legislature, we'd be well on the way to addressing problems like that.
Dave, I'm thinking that probably around Anchorage, it's kind of nice if you can see that the moose are coming out of the trees. But by the time you get up past Willow, somebody's likely to want to eat that moose. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, the moose at the edge of the conventional clearing is not a concern. And a moose at the edge of the super wide clearing is, well, well, but you haven't gained anything by clearing that wide safety-wise. And in fact, it's actually made the road more dangerous. The blowing snow is worse than it's ever been before, the icing conditions and so forth. But they're hard to communicate with. We'll keep trying, though. And would you approach through the governor or through legislators to find Sarah Palin's efforts?
Actually, a lot of them are online. If you just Google Alaska climate change, I think that's probably all you need to do, and it'll pop up on the administration page, and the reports are right there.
At least it's a start, Dave.
Hey, thanks very much.
All right, thanks for your call, Dave. Well, we're down to the concluding 2 minutes of the show. Who wants it? They look at one another.
Well, I appreciate Dave's call because I think it's a reminder that we all need to do what we can. You know, Nancy and I have chosen to primarily focus on writing and trying to create change that way. And what Dave is doing and what all the callers are doing in their corners of the world are really important. And, you know, I really think that what we need, we have a lot of science and we have a lot of intellect and discussion. And what we need is to become more passionate about all this.
Whoa!
And I think that's where artists and other creative folks need to get more involved, because I think that we need to change not just our heads but our hearts. And I think that the heart opening comes from people sharing their stories. It's one of the reasons I love Nancy's book, is because she goes to these communities and she listens to people and records their stories.
You know, I'm thinking, Nancy, you were talking about these areas that might be kind of reserved for carbon sequestration. And I was thinking, well, maybe actually you get better sequestration value by actually doing some gardening on it. A little bit of alteration here and there. You know, maybe gardening is a big part of this, because if I grow my own vegetables, they're not coming in on the plane and the boat and so forth. And I always thought that was a really positive thing to do.
Yep, absolutely. Local foods is part of the solution.
And local everything.
Local everything.
Well, I want to thank both of you.
Small is beautiful.
Where's the next reading, then?
Tonight.
It's tonight, 7 p.m. at Out North Theater.
Wow. And what are you going to read?
Don't know yet?
Mm-mm. We're actually going to read very short at that, and it's going to be more of a conversation with Charles Woforth, another environmental writer.
All right. Well, that'll be fun. Some of my favorite people. Thank you so much, both of you. Mary Beth Holloman, Nancy Lord. Thanks, Josh Edge, Pat Yak, Dave Waldron. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Help manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide critical advice to the Federal Subsistence Board on the management of subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing on federal public lands. The deadline to apply is February 18th. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. When you file online for your PFD, you can donate to any of the 91 organizations that help Alaskans pull their lives back together after an emergency. Get more with your PFD when you pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation and the Mattsu Health Foundation. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.